We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. There is a standard list that comes to mind when we hear the phrase America's founding fathers, including George Washington, John Adams, Tom Jefferson, John Madison. But what about our fifth president, James Monroe? Our guest for this morning, historian Harlow Unger, says that Monroe is often overlooked, even though it was during his presidency that the country's real empire building began. This morning, we'll be talking with Harlow Unger about his new biography of James Madison. The title of his book is The Last Founding Father, James Monroe and a Nation's Call to Greatness. Tekapo Press is the publisher on the book. And he makes the argument in the book that Monroe is the most important president in America's formative years after George Washington. And he says that while some of the others that I mentioned at the beginning, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, while they may well have been fine founding fathers and accomplished political historians, he says that they were terrible presidents. More on this in this hour of Focus 580. Questions, of course, are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana. To join the conversation, the number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And email is also a possibility, and that is the address to use is will-talk@illinois.edu. If you're going to do that, please keep it brief. That'll help us. And in fact, we really hope that callers will do that too. That way we can get in as many callers as possible. But certainly input either way into the program is welcome. Just a little bit more about our guest, Harlow Giles Unger. He is a former distinguished visiting fellow in American history at George Washington's Mount Vernon. He's a veteran journalist, broadcaster, educator, historian. He's the author of 16 books, including four other biographies of America's founding fathers. He makes his home in New York, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And Mr. Unger, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I watched you on C-SPAN. This was a talk about the book that you gave. I think it was at Borders. And it is very clear that you are quite passionate about Mr. Monroe and about having people understand his contributions to the country. Why do you think it is that he is kind of in the shadow of a lot of these other men, particularly those that maybe not so much George Washington, everybody's in his shadow, but the others that preceded him as president?
Well, I think that historians, like journalists, tend to emphasize the flamboyant over the efficient, competent acts and events of our political leaders. And James Madison, James Monroe, was certainly the most competent president. And indeed, you mentioned my passion. All Americans were as passionate about him during his lifetime as I am today. He was the most beloved president after George Washington, and the only president other than Washington to have been reelected to the presidency with no opposition. Mm-hmm. After he had completed his first term, no one dared to try to run against him, and indeed political parties disappeared. Everybody rallied behind Monroe under a single political banner, the Star-Spangled Banner. They adored Monroe.
That I think that's interesting that this at this particular time, for a while, there was a period of great sort of unanimity, cooperation, sense of purpose, in a sense, in American politics.
Absolutely. Monroe rallied the American people behind him. Like Washington, he had toured the country, visiting all the states and mingling with people. They presidents could walk among the people in those days. They felt very safe doing it. There were no guards at the White House and no security lines to get in. You just knocked on the door and someone opened the door and you walked in. So Monroe actually spent time visiting all the states and mingling with the people, unlike Adams, Jefferson, and Madison. They never toured the nation. Only Washington had done that beforehand, and Monroe repeated Washington's tour of the state. So everybody got to know him. Everybody got to love him. And he got to know the people. He left the cocoon of the Capitol, Washington, D.C., and went among the people to find out what they needed and wanted and rallied them behind him and expanded this nation westward, building roads and canals and tying the whole nation together and unifying it so that everyone could get their goods to market, everyone could travel more easily and visit other parts of the country.
I'm sure that we'll be talking about his service during the Revolutionary War, and one of the points that you make is that he was the last American president actually to have served, to have fought in the Revolution. Just one indicator of his significance, and I don't know if this is making too much of it, but it certainly is something that you point out. If people will recall the very famous painting of Washington crossing the Delaware, and if they close their eyes, they probably can kind of see it. At least they know that there's a boat that's full of soldiers, and they're rowing, and Washington is standing. And right behind him, there's a guy who's holding the flag. Well, that's Monroe.
And that's James Monroe. He, too, is standing. He's the only other figure who's standing in that painting. And the painting is symbolic. It's not an actual event because Monroe and Washington crossed the Delaware in separate boats. Monroe had crossed earlier, but the painter, the artist, is showing Monroe as the second most important figure in the Battle of Trenton behind Commanding General Washington, and also the second most important figure in American history at that time, as the second most important president. Now, at the Battle of Trenton, it was James Monroe, who was a lieutenant at the time, who was the unquestioned hero of the battle. It was his bravery, his courage, that helped Washington win that battle, and Monroe was actually wounded. Could have been a mortal wound. A surgeon happened to be there and was able to tie off the artery in Monroe's shoulder. He had been wounded by the Hessian soldiers, but he had circled around behind the town of Trenton and come up the hill to capture the two cannons that stood at the top of King Street and would have wiped out Washington's army it wasn't an army, it was a troop, as it came up King Street to capture Trenton. And that battle turned the war around. We were losing the Revolutionary War. Congress had actually fled from Philadelphia to Baltimore and was debating terms of capitulations. The British, the Redcoats, were in sight of our capital in Philadelphia, and Hessian troops were in Trenton. Washington's ragtag little army, down to about 3,500 men, had fled from after a terrible defeat in New York, present-day New York City, and in Westchester County to the north. They had fled across New Jersey and across the Delaware River into Pennsylvania and were virtually reduced to surrendering. It was this surprise attack on Trenton that turned the war around and showed that our citizen soldiers could defeat a professional army, in this case the Hessian troops. And that allowed Congress to go back to Philadelphia. They no longer talked about capitulation, and they began really preparing to try to supply our troops with adequate arms and ammunition and win the war.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, historian Harlow Unger. He is the author of four biographies of America's founding fathers. I guess now we should say five because his most recent, just published, is titled The Last Founding Father. It's a biography of James Monroe. He was the fifth President of the United States. It's published by DeCapo. It's out now if you want to read it. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. Maybe a little bit about his background. A number of his contemporaries who were involved in early America, they come out of the planter class. He was a Virginian. It seems in his background it was similar to other men, like Washington and Jefferson. Are there some important ways, though, that he is different?
Well, he really wasn't a member of the planter class, nor was Washington when they were youngsters. Unlike Jefferson grew up in the lap of luxury. His father had a huge plantation. Both Washington's father and Monroe's father were what you'd call second-tier planters. They had rather small tobacco farms, and Monroe grew up on a small farm in eastern Virginia, walked to a small one-room schoolhouse about 5 miles away from the farm. That was his early schooling. And interestingly enough, another student 3 years older who was in that same one-room schoolhouse was John Marshall, who became the pivotal Supreme Court justice during the Adams administration. Monroe did not grow up in luxury. His father died when he was only teenager, about 15 years old, and fortunately, his uncle was a rich man, and his uncle adopted the entire Monroe family and sent James Monroe to college at the College of William and Mary, and it was there that he got his formal higher education, enlisted in the war in the middle of it, fought in the war, returned to college afterwards, and studied law under Thomas Jefferson. And it was as a public figure that he began to earn a little money and gradually build up an estate. But he was never part of the planter class as such.
Yeah. I think one of the things that really marks him after his service during the war, he goes back to university, to college, that he apparently decided that he would go into government. That would be his career. And one of the things I think about him that's truly remarkable is that he, in all of the various many capacities in government that in which he served, it was a remarkable kind of resume when you look at everything he had done all the way up to being elected twice, to be president of the United States.
He was indeed the first American to decide on public service as his career, although he was a lawyer and did practice some law, as many public servants did. But he decided as his primary career to become a public servant and serve this country. He adored this country and wanted to spend his life serving it. So he entered the legislature in Virginia. And one thing about Virginia, everybody talks about the Virginia dynasty at that time because of Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe. What Americans don't seem to realize, and perhaps it's not emphasized enough in our history books, Virginia at the time of the founding of this country was the largest, wealthiest, and most heavily populated state. The rest of the country revolved around Virginia. Virginia stretched all the way to the Mississippi River and up to and around the Great Lakes, present-day Wisconsin and Ohio and Illinois, Indiana. Those were all parts of Virginia in those days, and, of course, West Virginia and Kentucky. So Virginia was the largest state geographically. It was the wealthiest state. Tobacco was the cash crop, of course, and tobacco was the crop that produced the most revenue for the United States. And it was the most heavily populated state. So the importance of Virginia in that day was the equivalent of California, Illinois, New York, Pennsylvania, and Texas combined. And starting out in the Virginia legislature was a big step in those days. He became governor of Virginia. He became an ambassador for the United States in France, in England, a minister to Spain. He became a Secretary of War, Secretary of State, and finally President. He held more public offices than any other man in American history.
And just to underscore the point about being, as you do, being the governor of Virginia, at that point, to be the governor of Virginia probably meant that you were the second most influential, powerful elected official in the country, probably only second to the president of the United States.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because the wealth of that state, the power of that state politically, that's what made the wheels of the American economy turn. So the president was heavily dependent. The federal government was heavily dependent on Virginia, much as today's federal government is more dependent on a combination of the large states than the small ones. And Virginia was the large state at the time. It was during the Revolutionary War, Patrick Henry was the first governor of Virginia, and it was Patrick Henry who really turned the situation at Valley Forge around by sending Washington adequate supplies, troops as well as arms and ammunition and other supplies. Congress was unable to supply Washington with enough arms and ammunition. Virginia could do it, though, and Virginia did do it and saved the Revolution.
We have a caller here. Let's talk with them in Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hi, could I ask you two questions about Washington's victory at Trenton? I think that victory at Trenton really turned the Revolutionary War in our favor, but I have two questions about it. And the first question is, we know that Trenton had a Hessian commander. He was a German commander. He couldn't speak English, and he was given a note that warning him Washington's army was approaching, apparently warning him that Washington was going to attack him. He didn't read it. He couldn't read it because he was a German. He couldn't read English. But and he apparently put it in his pocket, I've always wondered, since that Hessian commander knew how close Washington was, he really didn't have to have that message translated for him, did he, to know what it probably meant, what it probably said? As close as Washington was there at Valley Forge, he could assume Washington that letter warned him of Washington's attack, couldn't he?
Well, I've never heard of that letter before, so you're springing something on me that I've never heard of or never run into in all my research. As far as I know, it was impossible for the Hessians to know what the Americans were doing on the other side of the river. It was quite a ways away from Trenton. Certainly not within sight of the Hessian camp, number one. Number two, Washington himself didn't know about what he was going to do until just 3 or 4 days beforehand.
Yeah.
Even his second-in-command, later became governor of Pennsylvania, Reed, General Reed. General Reed pleaded with Washington only 48 hours beforehand, we've got to do something. We're going to lose the war here. And so all the evidence is that this was a last-minute type of plan, and it was conducted during they crossed over at night in a blinding snowstorm.
Yes.
So I don't know how the Hessian commander could have had any advance notice of this or seen anything happening. It was Christmas night. They had been celebrating most of the day. They didn't even post sentries when they went to bed, assuming that nothing could happen in that snowstorm. And when they awakened the next morning, Monroe curiously enough, his commanding officer was a Captain William Washington, who was a distant cousin of George Washington. The two of them and a small troop had sneaked up behind the town and gotten up to the cannon emplacements at the top of King Street, and one of the Hessian soldiers happened to come out of the barracks or the house where they were had been sleeping all night to relieve himself and saw them there and shouted out, "Heraus, heraus! The enemy's here!" And they all came pouring out of the barracks in their nightclothes with their muskets. But I've never heard of that story, so that sounds like mythology to me.
Well, I have one more question. After our revolutionary troops won at Trenton, that meant they had that Trenton armory, that the quarters of the Hessian soldiers, that they could now occupy those quarters. And I'm assuming that they got for themselves some equipment, some warm clothes, and maybe and some shoes. I mean, at Valley Forge, these men were ill-fed. They were ill-clothed. Some of them had wrapped rags around their feet. And I've always, when I read that story, I've always thought, I hope at Trenton they got themselves some good equipment, especially some warm shoes. Did they?
Well, obviously they took all the equipment they could get from the Hessians, but they didn't linger in Trenton very long. Cornwallis found out about the Hessian defeat and started marching against them, and they pulled out of Trenton then. And
went up to Princeton.
And well, they went near Princeton and caught Cornwallis in a vice as he marched towards Trenton, and defeated a small force of Cornwallis and forced Cornwallis to retreat to the Brunswicks. Then the Americans could relax. They now controlled most of western New Jersey.
I want to thank the caller. We're getting very close to our midpoint here, and I have someone else to bring in, and I would like to introduce once again the guest for this hour. We're talking with Harlow Unger. He is a journalist, broadcaster, educator, historian. He's the author of 16 books, including several biographies of America's founding fathers, and his newest is a biography of James Monroe. He was the fifth president of the United States, and the title is The Last Founding Father, James Monroe and the Nation's Call to Greatness. It's published by DeCoppel Press, and in the book, Mr. Unger makes the argument that of the men that had preceded him, aside from George Washington, that Monroe was the most important. His contributions to the country were the greatest, and second only to George Washington. And he feels that Monroe is someone who has been unjustly overlooked, that his importance to the country has not been perhaps emphasized enough, or at least it's not something that most people know about. And that's one of the reasons that he wanted to write the book. It's out now in the bookstore, so you can take a look at it. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have another caller here on our line one. Let's go there. Hello.
Hi. I just had a quick comment about the last caller's assertion that there was a message. I saw that on the History Channel, something about serendipitous times in history, where they said that I saw the same thing, where they got a note. They're all partying. It's bad weather. It's Christmas Eve. And one of the commanders got a note, didn't read it, you know, saying that we saw Washington coming. And I just wanted to make that comment, that I actually saw that on the History Channel, that little... If, whether it's a myth or not, I just wanted to back up that guy. It's like, man, I heard that too. So that's all I got.
Okay. Well, it sounds like Mr. Unger, from everything that you know about this, you're saying that you've never heard that story before.
Never heard it before.
Right.
David, you know, one thing we have not talked about, and I think it's very important, is James Monroe's wife, Elizabeth, who was probably one of the finest first ladies in American history. And she, too, has been overlooked as the great heroine she really was. She was absolutely beautiful, stunning lady, elegant in dress, brilliantly educated, and a very courageous lady. She and James Monroe had one of the great love affairs in White House history. He never went anywhere without her, and they had two daughters, and they traveled with the Monroes when... James Monroe went over as ambassador to France. When he went over there, it was the French Revolution was underway, so it was a dangerous time. He went over there twice, by the way, and the first time the French Revolution was underway, it was a dangerous time in Paris, and they settled into a home that they bought, as which became the American Embassy. They learned that Adrienne de Lafayette, Lafayette's wife, was in prison and set to be executed on the guillotine. James Monroe couldn't do anything without endangering his status as a diplomat, as an American ambassador. Elizabeth Monroe, on her own, got into the carriage. They had a carriage there. And told the driver to take her to the prison. She went through the mobs down to the prison gates and demanded to see Adrienne de Lafayette. She said she's the American ambassador's wife, and she insists on seeing her. And she saved Adrienne de Lafayette. They got her out of prison. She went to live with the Monroes for a while. And then Monroe smuggled Adrienne and her three children out of France. The mother and two daughters went to safety in Denmark, which was a neutral state at that neutral nation at that point. And young Lafayette, the boy, George Washington Lafayette, sailed. Monroe put him on a boat to America, and he went to stay with his godfather, George Washington, at Mount Vernon. So the story of Elizabeth Monroe and the the love affair between James and Elizabeth is really an important part of my book, The Last Founding Father.
Well, and that's I think that's also one chapter in the long story of the relationship between Lafayette and Monroe. They fought together in the war. There was a point later, I think after the events that you talk about, where Lafayette was destitute and Monroe helped organize a loan so that he could survive. And then later in life, when Monroe himself was at the end of his life and he was destitute, then Lafayette really wanted to try to help him, offered to do that. And Monroe, apparently being a proud man, turned him down. So there was, throughout the period of the life of these two men, they had a long history of involvement with one another.
Yes, a long friendship that began in Brandywine, Pennsylvania, the Battle of Brandywine, where Lafayette was wounded. Monroe, after his wound healed from the Battle of Trenton, went back into the war, and he served as a captain and finally a colonel when he ended his service. But he fought at Brandywine, at Monmouth, and at Brandywine, he helped save Lafayette's life. Lafayette was wounded, and Monroe helped carry him to the nearby church where he lay all night long, and Monroe stayed with him the whole night. Monroe had learned a little bit of French, and Lafayette had learned a little bit of English, and that night he kept Lafayette awake all night and kept her from bleeding to death, and the next day he was taken away to a hospital. But they became great friends, and Lafayette made many, many friends in America and held on to those friendships throughout his life, Washington being his closest friend, but Monroe also being a very close friend. And as you say, when Monroe was in Paris the second time and went to visit the Lafayettes, he found that this was after the French Revolution, and he found that the French Revolution had left the family pretty close to bankruptcy in really dire financial straits. And Monroe, who had just arranged to buy Louisiana from Napoleon, arranged with the same bank that loaned him money to buy Louisiana, he arranged for that bank to give lend Lafayette some money using as collateral lands in the wilderness that Monroe owned and had bought here in America.
I wanted to have you talk a little bit more about the Louisiana Purchase. If you look at a brief biography of Thomas Jefferson and look at the major events of his presidency, that's going to be one of the big things, the Louisiana Purchase.
Absolutely.
But it was, in fact, this really was, the man who was behind the Louisiana Purchase was not Tom Jefferson, it was James Monroe, although when he was sent to France, he wasn't sent there with instructions to buy all this land. He was sent there with instructions to do something much more, of a much smaller scale, and he really took it upon himself to arrange the financing and to buy this much, much larger piece of territory.
Right. We had just gotten rights to navigate on the Mississippi, so our goods were traveling down the Mississippi to New Orleans, And we needed a place to put to store the goods until ocean-going cargo ships could carry it to foreign ports. And Jefferson sent, and with permission of Congress, sent Monroe to France to negotiate the purchase of the island of New Orleans. That's all he was supposed to do. He was given $9 million, and those were his instructions. When he got over there, he managed to negotiate the purchase of the entire Louisiana territory, a million square miles. It more than doubled the size of the nation. He needed more money, so on his own signature, he borrowed another $6 million from a British bank and bought Louisiana. Now, of course, Jefferson gets credit for this because it was his administration, and he sent Monroe to do this. But he didn't send Monroe to buy Louisiana. He sent Monroe to buy a little island. And when the news reached America of Monroe's absolutely spectacular deal, less than a penny an acre at a time when wilderness land was going for $2 an acre. So it was an enormous coup that was hailed by all Americans. Jefferson was actually furious because Monroe had exceeded his instructions. Nonetheless, he couldn't go against public opinion, so he congratulated Monroe. But when Monroe got back, Jefferson almost didn't sign the treaty. He was buying the territory. He was very reluctant to do so because he believed that the purchase of foreign territory by the U.S. government was unconstitutional. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that the president or the Congress or the government can buy foreign territory. So he was reluctant to sell it, to buy the land. And finally, public opinion and Monroe convinced him to do so.
Well, how did it come into Monroe's head to do this? And why did he – wasn't that rather presumptuous, having been sent on one mission with a certain amount of money and then to decide not only that to go and borrow money on his own authority and to enter into this much different agreement?
It was, but his vision – as it went from the end of the Revolutionary War and after he finished his studies and traveled around the country, his vision for this country was to be an empire. He wanted to stretch our boundaries from sea to shining sea, literally. He did not see how the nation could survive as this tiny little strip between the Atlantic Ocean and the Mississippi River. He felt we would, and at that time, we were beset by enemies. We had the British on the north and northwest. We had the Spanish in Florida and in the southwest, in present-day Louisiana and Texas, and endless numbers of hostile tribes of Indians. He felt the only way that our nation could survive was to stretch our boundaries to the natural defenses of the oceans, of the big rivers and lakes, the St. Lawrence and the Great Lakes, and the mountains to the Rocky Mountains, and in the northwest to the Pacific Ocean. And then, and of course, he did this with the Louisiana Purchase. And then, when he became president, he sent Jackson with troops down to Florida to seize Florida from the Spanish and stretch our boundaries down there to the Gulf of Mexico and to the Atlantic Ocean in eastern Florida. After seizing Florida, and he negotiated with Spain not only our takeover of Florida, but pushing our western frontiers to the peaks of the Rocky Mountains in the middle and southern part of the West, and to the Pacific Ocean in what was then called the Oregon Territory, the states which included the states of Washington and Oregon. So he extended our boundaries to natural defenses and then proclaimed his famous Monroe Doctrine, telling the rest of the world, this is our hemisphere. It is no longer open for colonization. We don't want to get involved in your business. We'll stay out of your business. You stay out of ours. you'll find it far more profitable to trade with us than to try to fight us and conquer any territory. So that was his vision, even as a young man, and he made his vision come true, partially with the purchase of Louisiana under the Jefferson administration, and then with the extension of our boundaries, as I say, up to the St. Lawrence, the Great Lakes, out the Pacific Ocean, taking over Florida, and then strengthening our defenses around the rim of our nation so that we became impregnable to foreign invasion and foreign attack. And this allowed Americans to stream westward and settle what is now the great Midwestern area of our nation and become the most prosperous, most productive nation on earth.
Let us talk with some of the callers next to someone in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. If I remember U.S. history correctly, we used to refer to the era of James Monroe's presidency as the era of good feeling.
Indeed, it still is referred to that, too.
Okay.
It was referred to that at his time. That was a term made up by the Massachusetts Sentinel, which was the great newspaper of that day in the Boston area.
Well, my question is, to what extent was Monroe the beneficiary of that era of good feeling, and to what extent was he encouraging it, was promoting this feeling?
Well, he was responsible for it. He was responsible for it by, the victory in the settlement of the War of 1812, which ended hostilities with Britain, the conquering of Florida, both eastern and western Florida, and stretching our boundaries, as I say, westward to the peaks of the Rocky Mountains and to the Pacific Ocean. That opened and victory over a number of Indian tribes and settlements, peace settlements with other Indian tribes, so that the West and the rest of the entire country became safe for settlement. And the population was building here in the eastern part of the United States, east of the Appalachian Mountains. Once the West, what was then called the West, became safe for settlement, Americans streamed westward and started farming. They tilled the land. They reaped fortunes with timber, with animal wildlife. This huge economic expansion took place, and the prosperity that resulted made for this era of good feelings. And he encouraged construction of roads, building of canals to make it easier for people in the West to transport their goods to market. So he created the era of good feelings.
And would it be safe to say that in addition to creating it, that there were also like-minded people in the Congress who bought into this, who were out there promoting railroads and canals and all of the, these infrastructure changes that would bring this about?
Absolutely, and in the state legislatures as well. Remember, the federal government couldn't build roads. That was unconstitutional.
Right.
That was a state. But everybody was together on this. At that time, it's well to remember that, and really into the 20th century, politicians had full-time jobs. They were like you and me. They actually worked for a living, service in the legislature was almost voluntary. Senators made $9 a day to serve in the Senate. They only met twice a year, for maybe 6 weeks at a time. All the senators, all the representatives in the Congress, all the state legislatures and the various state assemblies, they all had full-time jobs. They were farmers and doctors and lawyers, and they worked for a living and went home to take care of their jobs and their families and return to the people they lived with. So that when they went to the legislature, they didn't think they had to pass laws. They knew what was needed, and they restricted their activities to what was needed.
Thank you.
We didn't have full-time politicians.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Harlow Unger. He's the author of a new biography of James Monroe, the fifth president of the United States. His book is The Last Founding Father, James Monroe and a Nation's Call to Greatness. It's published by Tekapo Press. We have a couple of other callers. Next, someone on a cell phone. We'll go there. Line four. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Yes.
Good morning.
Monroe sounds like both a creative and a practical leader, executive. And my question, I have two questions, I'll go off air. One deals with what kind of treatment did he give the tribal people of the westward expansion, especially the non-hostile Indians? And also, what influences did he have with the development of the Western Hemisphere in general, South America, Mexico? And I'll let you say something, and thank you.
All right.
You're welcome. Well, remember, at the time, the Indians were considered foreign nations, and each tribe really worked out its own agreement with the Americans. Under Monroe, Monroe sent William Henry Harrison to really destroy the Indian nations in the Illinois, Indiana, Ohio area along the Great Lakes, and there was a great victory in what is present-day Detroit, in which they forced the Indian tribes of that area to move westward and clear that area for settlement by the white man. As for South America, we had almost no involvement in their uprisings and their declarations of independence as each of these nations, South American nations, tried to throw off the Spanish colonial governments. We did patrol the waters. We had a navy of sorts, and we patrolled the shores of the Western Hemisphere right down to the tip of present-day Argentina and around on the West Coast. We sailed. Our ships went up as far as present-day the panhandle of present-day Alaska because the Russians were there, and the Russians tried to expand southward, and we sent our Monroe sent our gunboats up there to say, no, you are not coming anywhere southward. You're staying right where you are. And they did. They backed off. They had actually declared that those waters off the coast of the panhandle were theirs, and our gunboats said, no, they are not, and that allowed our fishermen to keep fishing there. So we patrolled our waters, and we made the Western Hemisphere impregnable to foreign invasion. And our leaders today might look at Monroe's foreign policy and defense stance for guidance today.
Well, if there's one thing I suppose that people will know about Monroe, or something that they will think about, is indeed what is called the Monroe Doctrine, which was the declaration that the Western Hemisphere was the sphere of influence of the United States, and that we essentially, various sorts of foreign policy decisions have followed from that, and I'm not sure everybody would agree that they always were the right thing, but what we said to the rest of the world was that this part of the world was ours.
And we also said, we have a different type of government. We are a different people, we have a different culture, and we have a different government and way of life. You are not going to come over here and try to change that way of life and this government. This is ours. Now, we're not going to try to change yours. You keep doing whatever you want to do, and at that time, the Europeans have been fighting among themselves for centuries. Monroe said, go on fighting if that's what you like, but we're not going to meddle in your affairs. Don't you meddle in ours.
Let's take another caller in Belgium, line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I must have misunderstood something you said earlier. In a statement you made earlier in your show, you said that Monroe was the last president to fight in the Revolutionary War. I'm under the understanding that Andrew Jackson actually fought in that also.
I don't know. I kind of think he was a bit too young.
Oh, he was a drummer boy in North Carolina, and he was actually injured by a British officer, which he carried that wound for all the way through his life, and he was very, very pessimistic about the British, if I remember right.
Well, I thought the story was, well, he was not injured in battle. I thought the story was that he was instructed to shine this man's boots, and he took exception to that and got in an argument with him, and the officer drew his sword and cut the young man, but that it wasn't certainly it wasn't something that he experienced in a fight.
Yeah. I see.
Yeah.
Well, so he was at least associated in some way, huh?
Well, a lot of people were associated in some way because.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, I was the one who said that. I guess I should make sure that want to make sure that that was in fact correct. What you were saying was that he was indeed the last American president to fight in the Revolutionary War.
Yeah. He was called
the
last Revolutionary War president.
He was at the end of his life. One of the sort of sad things about him was at the end of his life, he was destitute. And it seems that he was someone who always, all through his public service, if there were expenses, if he incurred expenses, he paid them out of his pocket, expecting that one way or another he would be reimbursed. And it seems that he really never was.
Now, every president went through the same thing. Washington, of course, when he took the presidency, was one of America's wealthiest men. So he could afford to go into the presidency, and he accepted no salary, only $25,000 in annual expenses. The salary was $25,000 still at the time of Monroe, and he was not a wealthy man. Jefferson also went bankrupt as president and had to sell his library that became the basis of the Library of Congress. And sell Monticello to survive, and he died bankrupt. Bankrupt and in debt. Monroe at least died debt free. He sold both his plantations, and was able to settle all his debts. He died here in New York City, at the home of his daughter and son-in-law. Penniless, but free of debt. And this was, unfortunately, public service. You didn't go into public service to make money. And most of our presidents and many of the other public servants did indeed die almost penniless because they had endless expenses as in public service. Mm.
He apparently, for example, when he was sent to France to be the U.S. ambassador, he thought, well, we ought to have an embassy. And he had bought a house thinking that Congress would pay him back for the expense.
Right.
And Congress never did.
Congress never did and never paid him back. Well, eventually they paid him back most of his expenses. They settled about 70 cents on the dollar in the end. Mm. But that was due to a lot of lobbying by Monroe's friends. They said it was a disgrace that a former president should be should have to face bankruptcy proceedings. So in the end, as I say, he didn't. He died penniless, but free of debt.
Yeah.
But this was true. Everybody had to do the same thing when John Adams went to Paris during the Revolutionary War. He had to foot the bill for his expenses. There was no way to transfer money in those days, and you didn't know what things would cost. You expected the Congress to reimburse you when you got home. And if political enemies happened to get into Congress and control the place, they'd say, no, tough luck.
There, and again, I guess just to go back to the relationship between Monroe and Lafayette. Lafayette apparently found out about it. It found out about his difficulties at the end of his life, and really wanted to help him out. And Monroe gracefully turned him down.
Yeah, it was fortunate that he continued his actions against Congress, and Congress finally did. Paying back a lot of the money that was owed. One of the things we neglected to mention was that as Secretary of State and Secretary of War, he was the only man that ever held two cabinet posts at the same time under the James Madison administration. And he all but galloped into action as Secretary of War in the War of 1812 when the British troops were invading Washington.
We're just about at the point we have to finish. Maybe we have about a minute, I guess, and I'm sure that historians and people who are interested in history can have endless arguments about how important people are and how you rank people. It sounds as if what you're saying is that one of the things that you have to consider with Monroe is look at what America was like even when he took office, or maybe a little bit before that, and look at what it was like afterwards and how much it had changed over that time.
Yeah, he took over basically the same country that Washington had bequeathed. The three presidents in between had done really nothing for the country except get us into a lot of fights. Madison getting us into the War of 1812, Adams getting us into a quasi-war with France, and Jefferson almost getting us into war with Britain, but imposing a trade embargo that almost bankrupted the nation. Monroe, who was this really dashing figure, great soldier, great hero in the Revolutionary War, became the hero of the War of 1812, and then as Secretary of War, and then entered the presidency and said, enough with these wars now, let's build up our defenses, let's cut out the wars, and let's build a peace here and make this country an empire, and he did.
Well, there we'll have to leave it for people who want to read more. The book is The Last Founding Father, James Monroe, and A Nation's Call to Greatness, by DeCapo, published by DeCapo Press, by our guest Harlow Giles Unger. And Mr. Unger, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.